Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on President Obama and nuclear tests. My name is Laura Flint. I'm an assistant director of practice groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome our experts, Professor Eugene Kantorovich, Professor of Law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, and Professor Peter J. Spiro, Charles R. Werner Professor of Law at Temple University Beasley School of Law. After both our speakers make their opening remarks, they will have a chance to respond to each other. Then we will open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us. Professor Kantorovich, the floor is yours.
So the immediate issue to be discussed in this call is the resolution passed by the United Nations Security Council, a resolution introduced, supported by the United States, dealing with the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, a treaty which outlaws all testing of nuclear weapons, underground and atmospheric. In the lead-up to the resolution, which was passed this week, there was some controversy about it in Congress and in the media, and the question was what exactly would be in the resolution. And there were many reports that the president was considering a resolution which would, in effect, adopt some of the terms or declare legally binding portions of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Now, the United States has not ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and it's quite clear the Senate would not ratify this treaty. The United States is a member of a different, earlier, more simple treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but has not joined the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and as a result, that treaty has not gone into effect. The president strongly supports the goals of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and would like to see the United States ratify it, but there's really no chance getting it through the Senate. So the discussion leading up to the Security Council resolution would be whether the Security Council resolution would contain provisions in effect articulating that parts of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty are binding as a matter of international law, or binding as a matter of general international law, or binding as a matter of Security Council fiat, that the Security Council would declare that the tests of nuclear weapons are a danger to international peace, and thus attempt to impose the treaty without the treaty-making process. And the objection to this was that it would avoid the Senate's treaty-making power. Now, that's not strictly true, because the Senate did give its advice and consent to a treaty, namely the United Nations Charter, which gives the Security Council the power to adopt various resolutions binding on the United States in order to respond to threats to international peace. It's not clear that the complete ban on nuclear testing, which many regard as an essential part of the security of a nuclear weapons system and thus of a country, would fall within the UN's powers. But it's not the case that there's no basis for such an action. Nonetheless, given that there is actually a treaty specifically dealing with this that has been negotiated and signed, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, turning to the Security Council after inability to get the advice of consent of the Senate for a particular treaty has the air of an evasion of the Senate's constitutional role, and also raises questions about the maximal powers of the Security Council. Now, in the end, it turned out that nothing dramatic happened at the Security Council. The Security Council passed a purely hortatory, recommendatory resolution saying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is great, and it says really great things, and we encourage everyone to join it, which imposes no obligations on the United States or anyone, and thus raises no questions of the treaty power, and leaves the obligations of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty where they were, that is to say, not binding on the United States. So in the end, the president did not do what some thought he might do, or maybe had considered doing, probably because of the salience of the constitutional concerns. That is to say, it would be in lieu of an actual existing treaty that has been signed. Now, the issue here fits in with what has been a critique of an Obama administration, and maybe also a self-conscious policy of the Obama administration at the same time, namely to use the United Nations and international law structures more broadly to bypass domestic political systems, which may or may not be constitutionally problematic, but basically to entrench through the United Nations and other international legal mechanisms to entrench or implement policies that would not be easily implementable through the domestic legislative system. So, for example, getting the Security Council to authorize the use of force in Libya rather than going immediately to Congress. For example, having the Security Council lift sanctions on Iran, creating, which itself raises no legal questions, but creates a state accompli for Congress. And most saliently, I think the biggest discussion now is the Paris Protocol on climate change, which is the next round climate stage, climate change emissions environmental treaty or agreement. I don't want to use the word treaty, advisedly, which is an agreement between nations dealing with emissions. And in order for it to become effective, a certain number of countries have to ratify it. And the ratification of the United States was critically important, counted by percentage of emissions. It is very unlikely that the Senate would ratify this arrangement. And so the president implemented it or adopted it domestically after signing it through an executive order recently. And this also raises questions, is this a treaty that has to be submitted to the Senate? Its scope and complexity suggest it is not a typical executive agreement. There are agreements which do not have to be, of course, submitted to the Senate. But this is large and ambitious. At the last minute, there were some changes of wording in this document, changing some shalls to shoulds, which suggests perhaps making it not that it is not mandatory or not obligatory, which takes away some of the concerns about the evasion of the treaty power because it would not be binding. So non-binding commitments do not raise the same treaty power questions. But again, it's not clear how this would be interpreted in the future. And so the should may avoid constitutional showdown today, but it is easily imaginable that a should will be said to mean shall down the road. And there are, of course, other shalls in the instrument. One of the most interesting features of the Paris Agreement that makes it particularly controversial is its with notice and termination, withdraw and termination notice period. So it requires basically 3 years notice and an extra year waiting period to exit the treaty, which means it takes 4 years, which happens to be the term of a president, of a U.S. President. And doing this late in the administration is seen as a way of tying the hands of the next president. I'll discuss what kind of constitutional question, if any, that raises. I think it's not a true constitutional problem, but more of, I would say, a comity or appearances problem, but it is clearly an attempt to entrench and create facts on the ground that are hard to change for an ex-president through international institutions. And I'll say in this regard, finally, before I close and let Peter talk, that the withdrawal period for this arrangement, whatever you want to call it, I happen to think it's more like a treaty than anything else. The withdrawal arrangement is, other than adding up to the unusual and magic number 4, is a very long withdrawal period by treaty standards. So most multilateral treaties that the United States is party to have a 6-month withdrawal period, or a 30-day withdrawal period, or a year withdrawal period, for example, is a fairly long one as far as multilateral treaties go. And a 4-year one, I offhand cannot think of anything quite as long. And, of course, there is a need for extended commitments in international law. But the way I think to conceptualize the question is international agreements, which can bind the United States, should be governed in terms of their entry and exit for domestic authority purposes, the same way statutes are and the same way constitutional amendments are. So the process for changing the Constitution is the same process for putting something into the Constitution in the first place, namely a supermajority. So you need a supermajority to get it in. You need a supermajority to get it out. The process for creating a law is the same as the process for eliminating law is the same as the process for creating one. You need a majority to pass it. You need a majority to repeal it. A situation in which a president can create an obligation that cannot be canceled in the same mechanism as it was adopted, namely unilaterally, raises truly, I think, difficult questions. Because one of the reasons we are comfortable with the vast use of executive discretion in executive orders is that the next president can and routinely does cancel executive orders without any legal concern. Now, there's no constitutional obstacle, of course, to the president violating the exit provisions of a treaty, because there's no constitutional obstacle to the United States violating international law. However, it is at least a legal problem to do so, that is to say, an international problem. And the creation of a legal barrier for the change of a rule that creates a greater difficulty to change the rule than to make the rule does, I think, raise constitutional concerns of the kind I think most prominent and most salient, relatively, I think, exotic constitutional concerns of the kind that were manifest in Clinton versus New York, the line item veto case. And I'll do it for there for now. Peter.
Thank you. So thanks, Laura, for hosting this, and thanks, Eugene, for those opening remarks. I'm glad to hear that Eugene doesn't really have an objection to the resolution on the nuclear testing, because it's pretty hard to make one here, first of all, because it is non-binding, and secondly, as Eugene points out, the Senate did consent to ratification of the UN Charter in 1945, overwhelmingly, actually, 89-2. And so I think it would have been clear, even if the resolution had been binding, that assuming that it was within UN Security Council power to adopt such a prohibition on nuclear testing, that would have been constitutionally valid under our own system, again, because the underlying charter was, the UN Charter was consented to by the Senate. So I don't think that there would have been a problem there. Eugene said that he thinks the U.S. backed off of a binding resolution because of constitutional concerns. My guess is that it was more for political concerns, and there may have been some difficulty getting other Security Council members on board with such a binding resolution. So I don't think the Obama administration would have shied from a binding resolution if it had made sense from other perspectives. So I'm not sure there's much of an issue there, I think, but as Eugene highlights in various ways, there is now a pattern through the Obama administration of developing what I'd call workarounds to the Senate's what I call constitutional obstinacy here with respect to consenting to the ratification of treaties. So the Article 2 route to consenting to international agreements now is pretty much a non-starter in almost every context. So during the 112th Congress, there were two treaties that the Senate consented to. That's an all-time low. During the Obama administration, the president has had a 27% success rate with submitted treaties, that is securing consent to treaties submitted for consent to ratification, which compares to 88% during the Bush administration. And I think maybe the best example of just how difficult it has come to be to secure Article 2 approval of a treaty is the Disabilities Treaty, that is the Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons, which the Senate failed to consent to in September of 2014 by a close vote, 61-38, that's 61 in favor, but falling short of the necessary two-thirds concurrence. And the Disabilities Treaty, which tracks almost completely the U.S. domestic legislation with the Americans with Disabilities Act in particular, the fact that that couldn't get through the Senate, that couldn't secure the requisite Article II supermajority approval, brings home really how in some ways impossible it is now to secure Senate consent through the Article II route. I mean, you had the spectacle of Bob Dole on the Senate floor basically pleading for the Senate to approve this, and it's still going down on the, as happens often in the context of supermajority requirements, and intensely opposed minority on really with some baseless substantive arguments. It was mobilized advocates of homeschooling who, without any real basis, argued that the convention would bar homeschooling in the United States, and just working from this general fear of international institutions that killed the treaty. So Article 2 is just pretty much a non-starter. Certainly, I mean, I certainly agree with Eugene when he says that if the Paris Climate Change Agreement had been brought before the Senate, that it would not have secured two-thirds majority support. That's certainly an understatement. But even for much less controversial agreements, there's a very low probability of success there. And so in some ways, the question here is what to do in the face of that Senate obstinacy. Now, one route, and this is the route that's been taken with trade agreements, is to secure simple majority support in both the House and the Senate, so-called ex-post executive agreements, that is, international agreements approved by both houses of Congress after they've been executed by the United States and other parties, so NAFTA and the WTO being the best examples, but other bilateral free trade agreements have been approved in that way. And that's still, I think, a plausible route with respect to trade agreements, and that's something that, of course, many Republicans are on board with, and so there are possibilities to get around the fact that, I mean, this general phenomenon of not being able to secure the cooperation of Congress on international agreements is, of course, consistent with the overall state of gridlock that we find ourselves in Washington. And so in the face of that gridlock, the Obama administration is innovating, I would say, to work around the gridlock at a point at which there are just necessities at the international level to deal with certain transboundary problems on a multilateral basis. And so there are two, I think, interesting developments here that we might surface a little bit that haven't gotten as much attention, although Paris has certainly brought attention to one of them. And so the two workarounds are executive agreements undertaken by the president alone, consistent with a congressional posture. So that's one, which I'll spend some time on. And then secondly, non-binding agreements really below the radar screen undertaken as a matter of cross-border regulatory cooperation. So on these executive agreements, here at point, maybe it can be posted to the Federalist Society webpage, a paper that Dan Bedansky and I have just co-authored on what we call Executive Agreements Plus. So there is a category of agreement that is generally accepted by even by originalists as kinds of agreements that that the president can undertake on his own authority. So one well-established example is claim settlements. So his, going back to the very early years of the Republic, presidents have entered into claim settlements without any kind of congressional approval. Other examples are status of forces agreements, agreements relating to recognition. So the Litvinov agreements in the early 1930s relating to the recognition of the Soviet Union. So there is some core agreement that presidents can do some, can enter into some kinds of international agreements on their own authority with no congressional participation. But those categories have been pretty well defined and cabined. And so something that the administration, the Obama administration has done that, that I think is new is to undertake agreements outside of these well-defined boundaries on the argument that it's not an exclusive presidential authority, but that the agreement entered into is consistent with existing legislation and Congress's posture to a particular problem as reflected in that legislation. And that's pretty much the argument that the administration is making with respect to the Paris Agreement, that it's consistent with existing legislation. So there's no law that's changed. It does not require any modification of domestic law, the Paris Agreement. Two other very interesting examples in this category are the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, ACTA, and an international agreement to control mercury. Both of which the president, well, the Mercury Convention, the president entered into and ratified an international convention on the theory that it was consistent with existing legislation. He made the same argument with respect to ACTA, although it has not actually formally been ratified. So it's sort of still an example in the making. And then there's a final category involving the intergovernmental agreements entered into under the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, the FATCA legislation, which have also been entered into without any form of congressional participation, on the theory that pre-existing legislation evinces a congressional understanding that international agreements can be taken pursuant to the domestic, to further the domestic legislation. So this category is, I think, is worth studying, and it's worth, I understand why there might be a wary eye cast at, towards this, these kinds of agreements, because it would expand pretty dramatically the context in which presidents could enter into agreements without congressional approval. And so maybe we can talk, to the extent that Eugene would like to discuss this further, and any members of the phone audience would like to discuss this. This is something that's worth scrutinizing. It's interesting that in wake of, and just in recent weeks, President Obama's ratifying Paris, that although there was some objection from quarters such as the Heritage Foundation, there was hardly anything approaching an uproar. And so it looks like this approach may stick, just as a descriptive matter. And the normative basis for it would be that if Congress wants to claw back any implied consent to these kinds of agreements, it can do so through subsequent legislation. So Congress, one thing to keep in mind in all of these contexts, is that Congress always has tools at its disposal to constrain the president and to reverse actions undertaken by the president. There's always this fund, there's always the spending clause, and there are other, and of course through the last in time rule, although as Eugene points out, there may be international law consequences to doing things like terminating a treaty outside of the treaty termination provisions. As a matter of domestic law, it's clear that Congress is always in a position to reverse a presidential action. The second category, which I'll just briefly note, is that, again, in the face of globalization, there is a necessity for transboundary regulatory cooperation, much of which conservatives would agree with, for instance, securities regulation. And that kind of thing, there is a lot of that regulation going on under the radar screen in the form of non-binding memoranda of understanding and other less formal transnational interagency agreements. And so there is a lot of stuff going on under the surface, which is just now a fact of globalization. In some ways, it's better if it gets surfaced in the way that Paris does. But this is just a fact of life, and efforts to the instinct of what I call the sovereigns is to take an ostrich approach to this stuff, that one can just put one's head in the sand and ignore what's going on in the world, is just not going to be sustainable as a constitutional strategy. It's certainly not sustainable as a policy one. I'll leave my remarks there and look forward to your thoughts.
Should we take questions, or can I make one or two more comments?
Sure. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. And while we're waiting for those questions to queue up, Professor Kantorovich, do you want to respond to anything that Professor Spiro said?
Yeah. Respond and just add what I think is...
You can continue.
Interesting point is, assuming the existence of this category of non-treaty arrangement, Professor Spiro talks about, one question, of course, is how do you know what's in that category that does not require the advice and consent of the Senate, and how do you know what's an actual treaty, which would require the advice and consent of the Senate? At least my mode of constitutional interpretation would eschew the need or international gravity and the mandate of events as a basis for determining what's a treaty. But one question that occurred to me with President Obama's executive order ratifying this treaty, this arrangement, is how other countries regarded this arrangement. And it seems every country that I have identified that has ratified this treaty did not ratify it, as many countries can with various international agreements, through executive action, but actually submitted it to their parliaments, including countries with similar notions of division of powers and requirements for some parliamentary input, such as the United Kingdom. In Australia, where there were some reservations about the treaty, whether it was or was not a treaty was actually a matter that needed the input and submission to Parliament, was a matter that received some discussion and attention, and their legislative consult service, parliamentary service, concluded that it did need to be submitted to Parliament and was. Now, of course, the U.S. Constitution is not the Australian or German or Brazilian or Chinese or Fijian Constitution, to name some countries who believe this is a treaty for their constitutional purposes. However, and their requirements of submission are not our requirements of submission, however, to address the basic question of, is this a treaty, is the document a treaty, regardless of how one interprets what it says, how the other countries whose names on it regard it would seem to be potentially probative, especially for the following point. So Professor Spiro says it's non-binding, and I am not an expert on climate change and its treaties enough to be able to say, but I understand the interpretation that it's not binding.
Oh, but no, I didn't say it's not binding. It's just that it doesn't require change in U.S. domestic law.
Ah, okay, it's not domestically, domestically. Right.
It's binding, but it won't. But for us to comply with it, we don't have to do anything. Sorry, I didn't, just to clarify that.
Because one can imagine these other countries, if they consider it binding on them, they will also expect it to be binding on us. So it's an interesting question, which is on the border. Professor Spear and I were discussing this before the call. It's on the border of the question of the use of foreign law to interpret constitutional issues. This is not looking at foreign law to interpret either our constitution or treaty provisions. It's to interpret an external document for constitutional purposes, namely, does this Paris Agreement constitute a treaty, but I would think that the behavior of other countries would at least be relevant to that determination. They're certainly not binding on us as a constitutional matter.
Okay, we're still waiting for questions. Remember,
I mean, just briefly in response to that, I think it's absolutely useful exercise to see how other countries approach this as a matter of their own domestic constitutional arrangements. I do see some irony, at least, in somebody who might have been aligned at points with Justice Scalia looking to constitutional, being careful to say it's not binding on us, but even on an informational basis to look at what other countries are doing by way of informing our own constitutional arrangements, which I have to say, while it's certainly a useful exercise, we have a very idiosyncratic approach to this, I think, where we have these multiple channels to ratifying international agreements. And so I do wonder in the end, I think our system is idiosyncratic enough in this respect that I'm not sure how much light it would shed on how a particular international agreement needs to be approached as a matter of domestic U.S. constitutional law.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I must say, though, I do indeed agree with Justice Scalia's views on international and foreign law and constitutional interpretation. I have written and continue to believe that in the few but non-trivial cases in which the Constitution explicitly uses international legal terms of art, such as law of nations, piracy, and in this case, treaty, looking to international law is not looking outside, but is actually incorporated by reference, in a sense.
Interesting. I mean, on that point, maybe this is a question to Eugene, if you accept the validity of any kinds of non-treaty, of any, the acceptance of any international agreements through a route other than Article 2, I guess that's a question for you, because, of course, the overwhelming majority of international agreements entered into by the United States do not go through the Article 2 route. The largest number are executive agreements that have been either approved, in most cases, expressly authorized by Congress, or approved after the being executed through bicameral majority support.
Yeah, so as a matter of constitutional text, I find it very hard to swallow, but it does fall into the category, like, for example, sovereign immunity on the other side of the political aisle, I think, of things which are hard to swallow textually, but seem to be undeniable as a matter of reality from days of yore. However, there is a question how far one can go, right? The real questions are what can you do with executive agreements and what can't you do? They've generally been understood to be limited in their goals, and how do you identify what those things are? And again, what makes the primary controversy around Paris is its unusual exit provision. In particular, its unusually long duration of the exit, which is structured in a way which I wouldn't say necessarily is per se unconstitutional, but is in a gray area of avoidance. Because again, it's true that any future president can violate international law without violating the Constitution, but it seems like a unhappy situation to place oneself in. Now, there is an argument, which I don't know if you have made, I believe you may have made it, that there is a way to actually exit this arrangement, the Paris Arrangement, not after 4 years, but after 1 year, which is to exit the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the umbrella international organizational arrangement of which the Paris Protocol is a product. And the Paris Protocol is only binding on members of the unpronounceable United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Control. So if you quit the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Control, you also get yourself out of the Paris Protocol, and the Framework Convention on Climate Control has a one-year exit period, which is well within the bounds of treaties that we are accustomed to. So the question is the ability to get out of the protocol through exiting the Framework Convention, is that enough to essentially give the president the same power to withdraw the next president as this president had to enter? And I'm not sure, because I think it's just two different things to exit the Paris Protocol and to exit the Framework Convention. Namely, the latter is bigger than the former. And one may imagine a president who doesn't wish to exit the entire Framework Convention on climate change, which does lots of other things and has other protocols and other documents. And requiring one to do a big exit in order to effectuate a small exit seems to partake of the kind of tying arrangement that the Supreme Court found problematic, for example, in relation to Medicaid subsidies to states in the Sebelius case. That is to say, you can get out of the big subsidies, but you have to reject the small subsidies too, is not really the same proposition as being able to reject the small ones on their own. So I think the four-year exit period remains an unusual and distinguishing feature of this arrangement that make it, at least on the facts, and I would need to reflect much more about whether constitutionally it makes a difference, but certainly it looks different from other agreements that have been entered into in the past.
Right, so it may look different, and so it becomes, you can look at it it may be an international law innovation, and there may be constitutional implications. I think the best way those implications are tested is to the extent that there's pushback on the ground, and that's the way that the line evolves between what kinds of agreements can be adopted and what kinds of constitutional ways is one of historical evolutions. And it is interesting that the pushback on Paris generally, leaving the termination clause aside, has really been, I think, underwhelming given the general skepticism of international institutions and of climate change among conservative constituencies in the United States, that there really hasn't been an uproar in the wake of President Obama's adoption of the agreement in recent weeks. It really was confined to a couple of op-eds and not too much more than that, which in my view evidences a constitutional acceptability, that to the extent that you've got a high-profile constitutional adaptation that is something new in this context that is basically accepted by relevant constitutional actors, including those who oppose an agreement on policy grounds, that lays a foundation for the acceptability of the particular approach. And so it will be interesting in the next administration. Well, I think if we've got a President Trump, then worrying about whether a termination violates international law is going to be sort of the least of our international law problems. But if we have a President Clinton, it'll be interesting to see to what extent she builds on this this foundation that the Obama administration set with respect to broadening the scope of agreements that presidents adopt on their own authority in light of the consistent legislative scheme.
Oh, so I think immediate shock and outrage by constitutional actors is a is a high and unrealistic test. I would I think even most living constitutionalists require a lot more than not immediate shock and outrage for constitutional development. I would just add, in connection to the election, I think one would make particular allowances for shock and outrage in the current period of time, which I think is called an officially recognized crazy time in America.
Right, okay, that's right.
Standards of shock and outrage are significantly shifted.
That's right. People's attention is sort of diverted at the moment, so that's a fair point. And that is, it is a fair point, and here is the way I would follow up on that, is that, so once this, assume, so we've got an election, the election happens, and assume we get the reasonable candidate, the one who's has some continuity with the rest of our former presidents in terms of background and likely approaches to governance, you know, being within the standard deviation. Assume that President Clinton does build on this and cites Paris and Mercury and ACTA as precedents. That would be the opportunity. It would still be sort of a provisional constitutional norm, to the extent that it's still emerging, and yes, people's attention was diverted elsewhere, even though Paris, of course, is a very high profile agreement, so it's not, one can't use the same excuse as one would use against the Mercury Convention, which nobody's paying any attention to. So I think that would be the way to keep an eye on this, assuming that we have a Clinton administration, is that with the next one, when people aren't so consumed with electoral politics, that's when the real constitutional battle might be fought.
Do we have any questions?
So far, we don't have any. Reminder to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. And while we're waiting for those questions, I'll make a programming announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be tomorrow on Tuesday, September 27th at 2 p.m. We will host a conversation with Josh Blackman and Nicholas Bagley on Josh's new book, Unraveled: Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. So keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and you can consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you might have missed. This is a final call for questions, but not seeing any. If Professor Kantorovich and Professor Speer want to make some closing remarks, you can go ahead and do so.
I don't really have anything more than to say, other than, you know, it's a very interesting time, because the pressures of globalization are really, I think, making it imperative that the U.S. participate in various international regimes, and the fact of Senate obstinacy in the long run can't stand in the way of U.S. participation in these regimes.
Okay, that'll be the last word.
Great.
All right.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Kantorovich and Professor Spiro for joining us today, and we welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next Teleform tomorrow, Tuesday at 2 p.m., and thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.